India Whiskey X-Ray. Joseph, please proceed. Give us your message.
This is KC1IWX, Joseph, broadcasting to Lower New York. I'm actually a radiation physicist and talking about the Bernoulli principle and what's going on with flight is actually quite intriguing because it's what I did as an undergraduate studies, and then I moved on to do things in master's thesis. But it's quite an interesting conversation, over.
Very fine, Joseph. We're hearing you very well. You haven't given us the information yet. You've told us of your credentials. What have you observed? What do you believe as to where the lift of a wing is coming from? And when you give me that answer, please include what you believe is happening on a thoroughly symmetric wing, a wing that's on an aerobatic airplane, for instance. Or, if I take an ordinary wing and I fly the airplane upside down, I fly the airplane upside down. Tell me what you believe is happening. Is Bernoulli giving me all of the lift? KC-1, India Whiskey X-Ray, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
This is KC-1IWX, Joe, broadcasting from Groton. Actually, there's several phenomenons that can go on with Bernoulli's principle that I observed with hydraulic principles that not only necessarily with air, but can happen with fluid. And one of those is hydraulic jump. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but normally with the lower pressure, it sucks it up, it gives you lift of the airplane, but with hydraulic jump, you can be at a certain distance in the air or water, which causes a back feed, which actually causes the water to create an actual vertical stance. We had one of those at Norwich University back when I graduated back in 2008, that we did for civil engineering. Are you familiar with that, over?
No, I am not. But with the thing that's before us right now, would the drone inside the box give us the weight of the drone on the scale that's on the outside of the box? Are you differing with that quasi-conclusion that we came up to up to this time, Joe? Over to you, Joe.
C1IWX, my elementary conclusion would be that the scale can only measure the force of the rotors pushing down on it if the actual drone is off the scale. That would be my elementary conclusion, that the scale can't measure more than what's on it, and it can only measure the down pressure force. Any conclusions, over?
The original question was, is a scale outside the box? The drone is sitting inside the box on the bottom of the box, and you zero the scale. Now you fly the drone inside the box, a foot or two above the floor of the box, and you let it hover there. Will the scale still be measuring the weight of the drone? Yes or no? Over to you, Joe.
This is KC1IWX. Joe, my basic conclusion would be the scale can only measure the downward pressure force provided by the propellers. So that's proportional to how much they can push down and push on the force. So I would say it would not be the same unless the propellers can put forward more force than the actual static weight of the drone, over.
Okay, let me be more specific, Joe, because we've got a bunch of ambiguities here. Assume I've zeroed the scale with the box on it. Assume the drone weighs 2 pounds. I put the drone inside the box, and the drone is sitting on the floor of the box. The scale on the outside of the box is reading 2 pounds. I then fly the drone, hover it 1 foot above the bottom of the box. Let's make it 2 feet. I'm hovering the drone 2 feet above the bottom of this box, a large box. Will the scale still read 2 pounds, the weight of the drone? Over to you, Joe.
This is KC1IWX. Joe, not to draw an allegory or anything to your thing, but have you seen the post on Facebook where they always show, like, the bottle of water pouring through a bunch of stuff, and they're asking you which bin will fill first? It's not a matter of the flow path more of a matter of its little rate. So when you're talking about a drone and you're hovering above it, the scales are only going to be reading the down 40 of the pressure it feels on the scale. So that drone could be running at 60% and only weigh 2 pounds and putting a 2-pound force on it, but it could be capable of putting a downward force of like 6 or 8 pounds, which makes the scale register harder. It's the same thing to do with the JF-35s or the other types of modern machinery where you can have a jet fighter fly essentially vertical because its thrust is greater than its gravitational pullback. Over.
Joan, you're not answering the question. When the drone is sitting on the bottom of the box, inert, not doing anything, the scale reads 2 pounds outside the box. When the drone is hovering 2 feet above the bottom of the box, inside the box, it's a steady state hover inside the box. Will the scale read 2 pounds? Yes or no? Maybe we've lost Joe. I think the conclusion we've come to, Roy, is that the scale must read 2 pounds. Because the box plus the drone, gravity is acting on every molecule of that system. Nothing is resisting 2 pounds of drone plus weight of box. Nothing is resisting all of that gravity other than the scale. It's a closed system. The scale has to read the weight of the drone even when it's hovering. The people who have a strong faith in Bernoulli and they think that the near-field effects of the wing creates this magic lift by faster air above, lower pressure above, higher pressure below creates lift and has no influence on the outside world. People who believe that usually come to a wrong conclusion when you really do the experiment. This drone experiment really has been done on Newton's apple by way of a radio-controlled model helicopter above a dining room table. The experiment has been done, and the scale continues to measure the weight of the helicopter while it is hovering above that dining room table. That's what that Newton's apple program 20 years ago on PBS showed us. And so the Bernoulli people have a lot of trouble watching that, and they say something's wrong. AC2GS, a darn good experiment, Roy. K2LIW, go ahead, Roy.
Yes, I thought it was a wonderful thought experiment. I mean, with the nature of thought experiments is if you think about it way too much, it gives you a headache and you find out ways that it's not as clean as it could be. I mean, is there possibly some inconsequential upward force that would cause it to be way, you know, 0.01% lighter because of it, maybe? I mean, the way that I think of it, a drop in pressure above a drone is not going to pull a drone up that much. If anything, it's going to pull the air down from above it and cause more of an airstream pushing the drone down. But for anyone who wants to see these things, I put a bunch of aliases up. If you type in drone.ac2gs.com, it'll give you a YouTube of a drone being experimented in just this way. Let me drop. All those articles on lift and Bernoulli's principle, there are two pages. One is lift.ac2gs.com, and the other one is lift2.ac2gs.com. And those are very nice web pages. If you have nothing better to do someday, take a look at them, read through them. They're very well explained.
Roy, when I go to your web address, is there a way I can dial in ac2gs.com and see the list of things that are available where I might not know the prefix of all of the things that are available to you, but is there a way that I can find your list of available information? Over to you, Roy.
It's a good idea. I haven't set that up yet, but I'll tell you what. Give it a day, and all you'll have to do is go to roy.ac2gs.com, and I will put a list of the aliases for everyone. Right now, I think it just has a list of books that I've been reading recently. But I will add the list of all the aliases to that page. So once again, give me a day or so and look at roy.ac2gs.com.
I noticed that you've got a pair of dots and no at in that address. So Roy dot is what you said, ac2gs.com. Is there no at anywhere in there?
No. The use of the at symbol is for the domain of an email address. This, on the other hand, is a web browser address that's just separated by dot. Usually it's www.google.com. But in this case, my domain is ac2gs.com, and the way that I put people to different pages is by changing the first entry, the limiter, before the first dot. So I'll have a list at roy.ac2gs.com, but you don't have to play with any ads. Ads are good for email, but they'll drive a web browser crazy.
Glad you made that clear. Okay, so in the next couple of days, roy.ac2gs.com will eventually give us the list of all of that available information, including this flight information, which is valuable stuff from my point of view. A highly misunderstood area. You got it, Roy.
Y2H.
And Y2H, go right ahead.
Good evening. Just a corollary on that aircraft going in, and you have a scale with a large enough surface area that detects the weight of the aircraft. What if we substituted that aircraft with a lighter than air, say a blimp? Would the weight remain the same? Would it increase or would it decrease, perhaps?
Okay. As I see it, no matter what you put in the box, let me think about that now. You want to put a blimp, a lighter than aircraft, in the box, and you want to know what changes. If you had a hovering blimp outside the box, then you placed it inside the box, I say the scale would read nothing, no change, because the blimp is displacing its volume in air, but the blimp just happens to have that exact amount of lift equal to the weight of that air. So that's a good one now, Lou. So placing a blimp in the box, the box will not exceed the weight of the blimp. This is now assuming the blimp is made for neutral buoyancy. Does that sound reasonable to Lou? NY2H, K2RIW in the group?
Well, I don't know. Roy, what do you think?
I would agree that it's not going to measure any weight because it's buoyant in air. That's what's keeping it afloat. There's no downward separate force opposing its gravity. It's all buoyancy, and as far as the environment, it's not sustaining any downward force that has to be negated by something strange. So it in the box it would be zero weight. Above the box, it would be zero weight. It, you know, that would be buoyancy as opposed to the method that drones.
Yeah, the drone is a heavier than aircraft. It has to continuously be displacing air, increasing its velocity downward in order to fly. Very similar to what would happen if I put a bunch of weights on my waist so that in a pool of water, I sink. But now I've got flippers on my feet, and I keep operating the flippers in order to keep my head above water. I'm continuously accelerating water downward. That's where the lift is coming from. That's how my head gets above water. So the flippers on my feet with weights on my waist in that pool of water, or an airplane flying, which is also heavier than aircraft, you have to feel the weight on the bottom of the box, so to speak. But that blimp when you place the blimp in the box, the volume of the blimp, that amount of air, goes out of the box. That amount of mass has been removed from the box, but you've replaced it with the exact same amount of mass. Because the blimp is neutral buoyancy, the amount of air it displaces and its weight are 1-to-1. So putting the blimp in the box does not change anything. And by the way, when you do fly the drone inside the box for a long period of time, you might see an extremely small...
Repeater, timeout.
The drone flying for a period of time inside the box, you might see an extremely small decrease in weight. Because the drone is stirring up that air, heating the air. Also, the heat coming off the engines of the drone and the battery is heating the air. And air that's been heated expands, has a slightly lower density. So the total air in the box becomes a little bit lighter because of the heating effect. But that's a very small effect. It took an extremely accurate scale to see that. But back to the blimp. That's a good experiment, Lou. Do you see what I'm saying about how the scale will not measure the weight of a lighter than aircraft, as a blimp is sometimes called? NY2H, K2RIW.
K2RW, NY2H.
Yes.
All things being equal, the displacement weight is equal to the weight of the blimp. That's why it's buoyant. It's not rising, it's not dropping, it's just hanging in altitude. What about the weight of the displaced air? Now, I know it's replaced by the weight of the blimp, but in these measurements, I guess the weight of the air is being taken into account. So if you replace the air with a vacuum, I guess your weight would register a little bit negative. But on this, no, I agree. It's the same amount of weight. The air displaced is the same as the weight of the blimp. One other thing, I sent you an email yesterday on a link on quantum radar, and I don't know if you got a chance to look at that.
Not yet, but maybe in the next few minutes I will look at my email. I haven't seen my email for the last quite a few hours. There is another person trying to sign in with a comment. Who is that other person who's trying to sign in? Go right ahead.
I have a question. N2EO.
Stand by, Rich. There is another person who has been trying to sign in just before Lou spoke. Who was that other person?
Oh, Joyville. Talking about neutron and solar predictions. So we're dealing with Bernoulli principles. So I kindly disagree. Over.
The person who says he kindly disagrees, please give us your call letters, your name, and tell us how you disagree. Go right ahead.
This is Kilo Charlie 1 India Whiskey X-Ray. I presented a paper at Boynton Doyle in New York City in 2008 with solar predictions and neutron predictions of basically solar weather. On top of that, I disagree with your analysis of the physics of how your hypothetical situation is occurring with the blimps and all that stuff. I do not agree. Over.
Okay. You've told us of your credentials. You've told us of the reports you've given. You've told us you disagree. You didn't give us the information. Will the 2-pound drone inside the box still give 2 pounds of weight on the scale outside the box when the drone is hovering versus sitting on the bottom of the box? You didn't answer that question. You keep changing to other subjects. Will the scale read 2 pounds when the drone is hovering inside the box? Mr. India Whiskey X-Ray, I think that's Joe. Go right ahead, Joe.
This is Joe. I want to make you understand what like my old, wiser physics professor than me said. So we're talking about a confined situation. So what I want to ask you, make sure we're on the same physics and understanding principle, because you want to have a baseline. is if you put a refrigerator in a closed room, like you're talking about with the drone in a box, and we put that refrigerator in that room and ran it, make the room go cooler, would that room go cooler or go warmer? Over.
The refrigerator in the room makes the room warmer. You still haven't answered the question. Will the 2-pound drone inside the box, will the scale outside the box read 2 pounds while the drone is hovering, the same way it measured 2 pounds when the drone was sitting on the bottom of the box? You haven't given us a yes or no on that very simple, basic question. You keep going to other subjects. You keep going to other subjects. Try to give us a yes or a no, or a maybe, or even the extenuating circumstances, but would it read close to 2 pounds with the drone hovering? Joe, go right ahead, Joe.
KC1, I relax. This is Joe. I actually really like you. In a closed circumstances, the drone pushing down in a forward force to actually, to basically, if you're capturing all the lift, pushing down on a scale would actually equal the weight that it had as a buoyant force going upwards as it was going downwards. So yes, in a closed box, 100% efficient, a drone pushing down the scale would equal the force of its buoyant force keeping it levitated. So yes, I agree with that point. Over.
Okay. Now, a person who is a pure Bernoulli principle believer has trouble with that one, because the rotary wings on a drone have Bernoulli's principle, lower air pressure on the top of each of those wings and higher air pressure on the bottom, and many of those Bernoulli believing people say that the scale outside the box will not measure the weight of the drone, that Bernoulli takes care of it. There are people who simplistically believe that way, and that's part of what I believe Roy is trying to correct tonight. Over to you for a comment on that one, Joe. K2IW.
In my undergraduate days, we dealt with the Bernoulli principle several times. One of those was calculating the exact time it took a 2-liter bottle to empty into oblivion, or empty, basically saying. But that took a cylindrical calculation and all that stuff. But yes, Bernoulli principle has its place. Can there be difficulties in calculating the exact principle of how something comes to turn or how something is? Yes. Can I calculate how a nuclear reactor works and how it will produce radioactive isotopes? Yes, with a certain insecurity. But is it exactly identical to what you want? No, that's what I'm trying to say, is that you're close, but it's not exact, and it's not exact science, because you don't have the ability to predict it. Over.
If I zoom way back there, Joe, what I think you're saying is that every scientific measurement has a degree of error, probability of error, and so on. And that's got to be taken into account. I know that Rich wants to say something. N2EO, go right ahead, Rich, K2RIW.
The bottom assumption is okay.
Negative. Please don't change the subject yet, because Roy has a couple of other corollaries he's going to be asking to this puzzle, so we haven't finished with this one yet. AC2GS, with the other changes you're going to make to the puzzle, go right ahead, Roy, K2RIW.
AC2GS, and let's beat a dead horse here. You have the drone, it's in the box, it's sealed in the box this time. We put the top back down and sealed it, and now we're doubling the air pressure. You could have it twice atmospheres or four times atmospheres. Does anything change? Now, you zeroed it because the weight changes, but you zeroed it. Other than that, does anything change in this experiment?
No.
And that was a very succinct, and you're quite right. The same thing happens. You get the same steady state, you get the same opposing forces, and you get the same force on the scale and the same measurement. Now you do the exact opposite. You suck all the air out of the box. So it's a perfect vacuum. Yes, I know there's no such thing as a perfect vacuum, but for this thought experiment, it's a perfect vacuum. Does anything change?
I say yes, but I have to get the details of what that yes means. Let's see if anyone else has a guess. Somebody said something, but he squeezed the mic so slow that it didn't come through. Squeeze the mic, wait a second, and then give us your answer. That other person go right ahead.
NY2H, I say yes. I say the drone's not going to establish any lift in a vacuum.
Here comes Roy for a comment on that one. Go ahead, Roy.
And Lou is quite right. The method that quadcopters and propellers use is by pushing air. And if there's no air, there's no pushing. So that quadcopter would just sit on the ground. Again, it wouldn't change, but it wouldn't levitate any place, which is one of the differences between something like a quadcopter and something like a rocket. Now, keep in mind that up until the time that we actually put rockets in space, there were some people who had problems with that. They sort of looked at things like the drone sitting there and wondered if a rocket would work in the vacuum of space. I mean, we take it as a rather obvious thing right now, but you have to understand that there was once upon a time when there were no rockets in the vacuum of space. So it's another curious bit of technological history.
Comment.
Or BDH.
With the higher pressure, the rotors would have to turn as fast, right?
Yes, given the efficiencies of the motor, you could run it at a lower speed to get the same amount of lift. Yes, you could check this experiment rather easily, and as I mentioned, there are uses that demonstrate it. So, trust me, except for, you know, down to the 0.0001 or whatever, it basically works the way we're talking about it working, you know? Nothing is perfect. There's always real-world complications, but we're trying to use this as a bit of a thought experiment to get the gray matter working a little bit faster.
Part of the understanding of this experiment, from my point of view, Roy, is the fact that an aircraft does its lift, a heavier-than-aircraft, by taking a massive fluid called air and accelerating it in a downward direction. It accelerates it in some other directions, but the downward component of the direction of acceleration of the air is what's creating the lift. The wing creates acceleration of air downward. And we all forget about how heavy air is. 2.7 pounds per cubic meter. Air is heavy stuff. We all forget about the experiment we did when we were 10 years of age. We stuck our hand outside the window of the car. Your father's car was driving at 40 miles an hour, and something very heavy was hitting that hand. You remember that experiment. 2.7 pounds per cubic meter. When you take the tremendous numbers of cubic meters that are being deflected by the wing of a 707 or a 747 airplane as being deflected downward, it's creating an amount of acceleration of that air that when the 747 is fully loaded, almost 750,000 pounds of deflection, of acceleration is taking place. That rocket engine in space is taking a fluid, which is the fuel that has been accelerated by the heating of that rocket engine, and a massive fluid is being accelerated out of the back. So the rocket doesn't have to push on air. It is taking a fluid and accelerating it. The wing of an airplane is taking a fluid called air and accelerating it. That's the primary component of where lift is coming from. A purely Bernoulli believing principle person has a lot of trouble with that one. AC2GS, K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
KC1IWX, do you know who Robert Goddard is, over?
Yeah, Goddard is the guy who's named after the Goddard Space Center. He's the guy who first, in the 1900s, built a liquid-controlled rocket, a liquid liquid fire rocket, and he was flying these things under his own finances. Go ahead.
C1 IWX, you realize you're arguing with someone who actually believes everything you just said. But we have some subtle disagreements, and definitely I saw Robert Goddard in Worcester and how he set up his thing in Worcester Polytech. So I'm quite familiar with his technology, or.
Very fine, Joe. So you probably want to go on to the additional corollaries of your experiment, Roy. AC2GS, K2IW, go ahead, Roy.
Well, those are pretty much all the corollaries I had in mind. If you have some, I'd love to hear them. But you know, there's only so much you can get out of even this. But you know, getting back to the way that you're describing it, there's a bunch of different ways of describing the phenomena. I think for me the easiest approach is the conservation of momentum. If you have mass times velocity going down, your drone has to have mass times velocity going up in order to balance the gravitational force that's trying to get it down. So I look upon propulsion as a means of conserving momentum.
WV2U.
Yes, I believe there's a WV2U. Do you have a comment, WV2U? A question? A comment? A statement?
Yeah, WV2U. Go right ahead, Paul. We all heard a very distinct WV2U. Go right ahead and make your comment if you want to, Paul. Go ahead.
That's one of the complications, and that's why everyone keeps on the word steady state. When you're accelerating and it's no longer in a steady state, then you're pushing more than the weight of the object was, so the measured weight on the scale would increase until you reach some steady state position and continue to hover. So accelerating isn't the same as hovering.
And there would be a double change in that one. As you first start accelerating upward, the scale will read higher than 2 pounds. During the time you're moving at a steady velocity upward, the scale will come back to 2 pounds. When you reach the altitude you want and you stop increasing and now you go back to hover, the scale will read less than 2 pounds as a transient. So there'll be two transients in that upward acceleration and upward deceleration in order to move the helicopter to a higher altitude. The upward acceleration magnitude and the upward deceleration magnitude will equal each other. So if you averaged over a long period of time, you'll still read 2 pounds. But you can create transients in this situation. By the same token, when you land the helicopter on the floor, at the instant it touches the floor, there'll be an upward transient when you make contact because you've got a downward moving velocity of drone striking the floor where the velocity is going to zero, so you get an upward transient of force. You go above 2 pounds at the instant the drone touches the floor when you decide to stop hovering. That's my guesses. AC2GS, K2IW, go ahead, Roy.
Yes, I agree with you, Dick. The devil is always in the details. That's why thought experiments use very bare bones, very simple, without the complicating nature of reality, because reality will always throw you all kinds of curveballs. So yeah, there's variations of change. The general statement I tried to keep saying was steady state and hovering, in which these variations don't aren't introduced into the question. But yes, any kind of shift and change in position is going to cause the scale to read different weights back and forth. So I agree.
Yeah, Lou, you wanted to say something? NY2H, go ahead, Lou.
Well, this is probably in the realm of transients also, but I was thinking about, and corollaries, the V-stall type aircraft where they can pitch the propellers down or, you know, and hover or pitch them, you know, towards the rear and transit. So, but that's all, I think it's all the same. So I just wanted to throw that in there.
Concerning transients, if I took a bathroom scale and put it in the bottom of an elevator, and I'm standing on that scale, the scale will read my weight. As the elevator starts accelerating upward, for a short period of time, the scale will read a higher number while it's accelerating. After the elevator reaches a steady state velocity, the scale will come back to my normal weight. When the elevator arrives at this floor where it's going to stop, as it's starting to slow down, the scale will read less than my weight. And when the elevator comes to a complete stop, it'll go back to my weight. So the acceleration of me standing on a scale in an elevator has a corollary to what the drone is doing when it accelerates upward and downward, so to speak. AC2GS, K2IW, go ahead, Roy.
AC2GS, you're getting precariously close to Albert Einstein's equivalence principle, that objects that are accelerating at a constant rate are indistinguishable from objects in a given gravitational field. So you're in good company there.
And just before you started talking, there was someone also making a comment. Who was that other person? Go right ahead.
KC1IWX agrees the gamma constant is much more complicated than that. It's actually the square root of 1 minus square root of light squared over the velocity squared, which gives a distinctive speed and correlation to the actual constant to predictions of the speed of light estimation. Over.
Dick, did we talk about the speed of light? I don't remember talking about the speed of light.
Nor do I, and that's introducing another subject. So, please continue with your science and physics talk, Roy. AC2GS, K2IW.
AC2LR.
Okay.
Was I acknowledged? This is AC2LR.
Yeah, we're all going too fast on the mic. We all have to squeeze and then wait a second and then talk. Go right ahead, Kay.
Earlier, Roy, you were talking about neutrinos not able to go faster than the speed of light, something about traveling from Switzerland to Italy. And I wanted to comment on that, too, where Hawking's book, The Grand Design, he was saying the expansion of space was faster than the speed of light during the Big Bang. Just a comment, just relaying information from the book. Back to you, Roy. This is AC2LR.
Yeah, Kay, I read it too, and I agree with you. That's a kind of generally well-regarded concept, that it's impossible to travel through the fabric of space-time faster than the speed of light, but can produce whatever space-time is at any rate that you want to, because you're not producing it through itself. You're just making more of the same. So you can increase the amount, the volume of space-time at any rate that you want to. There is no invariant limitation such as all things that travel through space-time have with the speed of light.
I think that's called the period of inflation that supposedly occurred right after the Big Bang. I am guessing the theorist needed the so-called period of inflation where the material moved for a while faster than the speed of light, so to speak, in order to get the distribution that you see today. And I presume that's required because everyone believed that all the material before the Big Bang was in a singularity, a point of zero volume. And that may be in question. The material could have been before the Big Bang in some kind of a distribution inside of that, I'm going to call it black hole. And if that was true, if the material started off with the distribution inside of the black hole before the Big Bang, would we still need that period of inflation? EC2GS, K2RIW.
KC1IWX, did you write an extravagant universe by the guy that was the father of the my girl? He basically said that that's not true, and the expansion happened in less than one ten millionth of a second over.
Yes, we've talked about this before, that the proposed time period that inflation took place was in something like the first 10 to the minus 41st seconds of the beginning of the universe. And it's all a bunch of theories. There are many theories. We talked about that with Stephen Hawking, that there's a myriad and a plethora of different ideas. And you're quite right, Dick, in that the reason why inflation is so beloved is to explain the somewhat regular isotropic nature of an incredibly large universe given the time frame, that it sort of strikes them as odd that you could get from one place to the other place with it being perfectly, it's very smooth. It's the differences between the cosmic background, the microwave, is infinitesimally small. We're kind of overemphasizing the difference. And that's why people, the physicists, really love inflation. Now, there are some guys out there who were part of the people who started the inflationary theory who changed their mind and don't like inflation. So, you know, there's no proof definitively of any of it.
Back in the early days in which we thought there was a geocentric universe, and you looked at the movement of the planets, where they sometimes backtrack, and they came up with epicycles as a way of trying to explain it. I think there's a slim possibility that the period of inflation, where in some infinitesimal period of time you've got things moving at much, much faster than the speed of light in order to explain the current distribution, that could be another one of these things that is an explanation that works for a while, but as greater knowledge is required, that spooky action at a distance might not be required. So I think you're saying that some of the early believers of inflation are starting to change their mind. Is that sort of what you're saying, Roy? That's the way you read that? AC2GS, K2RIW.
AC2GS. Physicists are very creative, and they can come up with a lot of different theories, and sometimes they really like to change their mind. So, yes, there are guys who were pretty much the father of inflation who moved on to different possible theories. But, I mean, you take someone like Stephen Hawking, his most recent paper before he passed away. His idea, his premise, is that inflation hasn't stopped, that the hyper-universe, the meta-universe, the poly-universe, whatever you want to call the bigger-than-universe, is actually still inflating at these ridiculous rates. It's only us here in our little pocket universe that have kind of popped out of the inflationary rate. So it's all open to conjecture because no one has the faintest idea of how to prove any of this. I'm looking forward to the day that we can figure out how to measure gravitational waves that go back to the Big Bang, because that's going to give us a lot of interesting new information.
And new LIGO-like machines are, I think, being proposed. Gravity measuring machines are being proposed. And, let's see, what else? Oh, yeah, new spacecraft are being launched, too, which Paul's going to be getting into pretty soon. So, I guess whether or not you think it's the right time to go over to the space report is your choice, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Well, let's try to merge one subject and see how it works. Paul, I don't know if you reported on it. Did you ever report on the microscope mission?
This is KC-1 IWX trying to report information on the microscope mission. I'm willing to testify. Over.
Okay, let me see if I have it. WS-2N. No, I didn't talk about it, but I believe you're talking about the one where looking at suspended particles in a fluid and looking at it in 3D under a microscope. Is that the one that, information is just coming out about that? Is that what you're talking about, Roy? Presently doing on the International Space Station.
No, this is a French, something like a 300 kilogram cube bat that has two hollow cylinders of different material with different densities, the same size, and it has an electrostatic field that's keeping it in position, and its reason for existing is to kind of prove what we all kind of think that Galileo proved many centuries ago, that objects with different mass are acted on equivalently by gravitational fields.
I'm not sure about this one. I know we launched gravity probe A and B, and they did work in that regard, but it has to do with a microscope in space. I'm not familiar with this one. It sounds like Kness put it up there. It was a French on maybe an Ariane 5 rocket. If it is it an older mission that they're just getting information? It doesn't sound like a newer mission, Roy, back to you.
Yeah, it was a mission that launched in 2016. There were some preliminary reports in 2017. And there was a recent article on the subject about a month or two ago. And the premise is that the guys out there who are trying to scratch their head and figure out what dark energy and dark matter is about really would love if gravity didn't quite work the way we think it does. And their theories are that maybe at the outermost edges of experiences, gravity starts to get a little wobbly and strange. And so one of the many things that they wanted to measure is how equivalent those masses are affected by gravitational fields. You have the story of Galileo throwing a light ball and a dark ball off the Tower of Pisa, which never actually happened, to realize that they both reached the bottom at the same time. What he really did was take two balls of a difference and roll them down an incline in a way that he could measure them more accurately. But the concept is that no matter what the mass, it's acted on by gravity in the same exact way. Let me drop. So what they decided to do, the French, and unfortunately all the YouTubes that discussed this in French, so if you don't speak French, I won't point you to YouTube, but if you do know French, you can go to YouTube and look it up. Anyway, the two hollow cylinders are made of slightly different material, the same exact dimensions, slightly different density, so slightly different mass, and there's an electrostatic field that's controlling their motion as they orbit high above microgravity, above the Earth. And the question that they had was, measuring these two objects with a different mass, would there be any inherent difference in the amount of force necessary to keep them stable? And up until recently, they were able to prove that the weak equivalence principle works to something like 10 to the minus 11. With this device, as reported a couple months ago, they brought it up to 10 to the minus 15. So that's even more accurate. So as we get more accurate, we keep proving that gravity works the same no matter what, which upsets some physicists because they would really like it to act strangely because it would answer a lot of difficult problems with dark energy and dark matter.
Get the name of that mission, Roy. You don't have that, right?
Yeah, it's the microscope mission.
So they're trying to prove that gravity has a linear relationship, essentially all the way down to zero, at least in one part to 10 to the minus 15. So therefore, gravity suddenly becoming repulsive as opposed to attractive, way out at the limit of our observable universe, where the material is accelerating away from us. That's the so-called dark energy conundrum. So I think some of the gravity experts wanted gravity to be nonlinear as you approach zero. And I think you're saying the microscope experiment gave strong evidence that it appears to be linear, as close to zero as we could get in that experiment, is what I think you're saying, Roy. AC2GS, K2IW.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. And science has kept on being fed on gravity in ways that probably confuse people. You would think that gravity working in short distances was something that they worked on in the 19th century. But up until about 20 years ago, the closest they tested gravitational forces were in the middle, because gravity is such an incredibly weak force in relation to electromagnetism. It's weaker by a factor of 10 to the minus 35. So it's very weak, and it's very difficult to measure. And up until recently, as I said, a few millimeters. But last year, they did some really esoteric research by banging neutrons into helium atoms, and they measured gravitational forces in nanometers, which are really small measurements, and it's unchanged. So once again, as far as nanometer distances, gravity holds up exactly as it does at any other distance. There's a whole bunch of interesting weird theory, of string theory, of 11 different dimensions, and seven of them are curled up in a very, very small length. And some physicists still believe that if you test a gravity at that minuscule length, gravity will be nonlinear at that length. And they really would like that to happen, but I don't know if they can figure out an experiment to get that smaller length. But they're working on it. So gravity is not a done deal. People still working, spending a lot of time and money on gravity. Okay, Dope, that's pretty much it for tonight. If there's any questions or comments or statements, please tell me. And once again, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com. And if you give me a day, I will set up something at roy@ac2gs.com, which will have links to many of the things that I've been talking about for all these months.
And to me, it's Roy. Well, I have a question for you, Roy. When you're transmitting on your radio, can you watch your push-to-talk light to make sure you're not releasing your microphone, maybe your service is failing, and your radio maybe going off for a split second and come back on? Because you're the only one that's doing it that I'm listening to so far on the net. Everybody else that's hitting the same receiver you're hitting is not doing the same thing you're doing.
Well, number one, yes, I'm looking at my little indicator on my radio, which is nice, bright red, and it's not flickering at all. And in addition, when I'm not doing this TechNet over at lovely Limar, I'm doing another TechNet at the Kings County Radio Club, which I record. And I played it back, and I wasn't cutting off there, and I'm using the same system with the same trigger and the same finger. So I don't think it's that I have a weak trigger finger at this point.
Okay. Just an observation I'm making, that's all. WHYY, listening.
Okay, I mean, I thought of it as well, and that's why I realized that the quickest way of answering that would be to just pull the recording from the other repeater and listen to myself, and wasn't doing this, so it's not my push-to-talk button. I mean, I could try doing something that doesn't require the push-to-talk button, but I really don't think that that's going to make any difference. Okay, this is me with no push-to-talk button. I've software-directed the radio to just transmit as though there's no push-to-talk button, there's no mechanical object, it's all electronic, so you can tell me if I dropped that hole, and if I did, then can tell me that, okay?
You just dropped out.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It's not the push-to-talk button. I would like it to be the push-to-talk button because I should fix it or get a new one, but no, there's something else going on.
Is it time for a poll? Going to your Roy?
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much for listening, and Paul, please give us your space report.
Very good. And as far as any French text, if it's text, if it's a YouTube, then you're out. But if it's text, you could do that. You know, there's Google Translate. Sometimes I look up these Russian launches, and I'll take the Russian text from their website and put it through that, and it decodes the whole thing. So I'm sure you know about that, right, boy?
Yes, I do. Matter of fact, the websites have a lot of information. There's a site also, if you want to type in microscope.ac2gs.com. I found a very informative website in English. I was just looking for YouTube because I thought there would be pretty pictures and better explanations, but they were all in French and there were very few illustrations.
Very good. Okay, very good, Roy. I'll try that tomorrow. I'll look into that. I missed that one. There's only a couple of 150 launches or so per year now, and that one got by me. Okay, this is WS2M for the Space Net Report for the TechNet, and we don't usually cover any kind of politics, but this one's kind of important. NASA finally has an administrator. We went from zero to somebody, Jim Bridenstine. We had an acting administrator. He was never confirmed. Robert Lightfoot last, I guess almost 14 months or so. But now they finally confirmed this one fellow from Oklahoma, Jim Bridenstine. So that might help things along. We'll have to find out how that works out, but the longest run that they've had was that one, and he's the 13th administrator for NASA. A couple of important launches, I think, are coming up on May 4th and May 5th. May 4th is the Falcon 9 that's going to be going up from Florida, from Launch Complex 39A. And they're putting a geosynchronous satellite into orbit for Bangladesh. So, it just sounds like another launch until you realize this is a new rocket, an upgraded Falcon 9 that SpaceX is putting up. There's been different iterations over the years, you know, like a Falcon 9 version 1, 2, 3. They've gone up to 4, and this one is a 5, so it's got a lot more improvements. The present Falcon 9 boosters, they've only been able to reuse once. This is a real beefed up one, and they expect to be able to reuse this thing 10 times and then actually rework it and use it for another 10 times and keep doing it up to about 100 flights. And if this works out, he's going to need to build a lot less boosters. You won't need them. He'll keep reusing the same ones over and over again. And it has a heat shield to protect all the piping, electronics, and everything right above the engine compartment. So when it comes through the atmosphere, it won't damage anything. He's got better thermal protection on the walls of the whole booster, so it doesn't heat up. He's got on the top, he's got these fins that always come out, these four fins that, as it's coming through the atmosphere, it guides it back to either land, you know, back to Cape Canaveral landing zone 1, or back to a drone at sea. And he's used aluminum ones in the past, and they get all burnt up and, you know, from the heat, from reentry. And he says they're very expensive to use and to build, and now he's come up with these titanium ones. He's tested the titanium ones about three different times so far. So so he knows they work. They're actually bigger, so he's going to have better control over the vehicle as it comes back through the atmosphere. So that's another improvement. And looking at it, you can tell the difference. The top part of it is going to be a lot darker. And